The apostle has built a rock-solid case for listening to Jesus as opposed to any other messengers from the past, either Moses or angels that have spoken in the past. That Jesus is the apostle, the one sent, and the high priest of our confession. And that he occupies a unique position of authority as a son in the house as opposed to being a servant in a house. And he has reminded the readers that they need to hold fast to that boldness and that glory. And then he refers to incidents in the past that demonstrate that whenever you don't listen to God's word, there are consequences that are not good. And the consequences, of course, of the Israelites who turned their back on God's instructions and suffered his wrath. There's one particular one that he mentions, the provocation, which of all the various times that they refuse to listen to God, the one that really stands out, of course, is the one that resulted in the adults not being able to enter into the promised land. Everyone who was over 20 years of age, except for Joshua and Caleb, perished in the wilderness. So, So to anyone familiar with Hebrew history, these would be very vivid examples of the point that he's making. Because they erred in their heart, this verse 10, and he says they do always err in their heart, which points to the fact that it was their choice. They decided that that's what they wanted to do, that they wanted to reject God's instructions. And then they were on the receiving end of God's wrath. So then in verse 12, he said, take heed. In other words, listen up. Pay attention. Think about some of my teachers in times past, especially Miss Kelsey. You know, I don't know why she really sticks out in my mind, but that senior English teacher, she was the quintessential iron-fisted English teacher. Listen up, pay attention. Well, that's the force of this admonition. Take heed, watch out, pay attention. Brethren, lest haply there shall be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief and falling away from the living God. So, what is the end result of a hardened heart? Exactly, separation from God. So that in and of itself should be enough to make people sit up and pay attention and indeed take heed. This chapter is just filled with expressions and phrases and points that are contrary to the proposition that once you're saved, you're always saved. We'll get to that in the last question in a moment, but this is clearly one of them. He addresses them as brethren. They were partakers of the heavenly calling. They were in the house of God, as he characterized it back over there in the first part of the chapter. He's already pointed out that they needed to hold fast in order all the way to the end. And so here's another warning about falling away. it is indeed possible to fall away from God. But exhort one another day by day, so long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Before we talk about the responsibilities of that we have toward one another, let's explore this matter of the deceitfulness of sin for a moment. What is it about sin that can be deceiving or deceitful? What are some examples or illustrations of that? All right. Yes, something that really makes you feel good and, you know, may be sinful. Okay. Later on in the 11th chapter, he talks about the pleasures of sin that Moses refused to participate in. So yes, sin can be pleasurable. Okay. Thomasina? Mm-hmm.
Just lull you into that sequence of, well, it's okay. It's
okay. Okay, yeah. So Satan is very patient. And he'll take a small victory. Even the most minute little tidbit of what might seem to us to be insignificant, he's delighted with that because, like you say, it becomes easier and easier and easier. Jim? Okay.
Because you're comparing against the wrong yardstick.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be deceitful in that sense.
All right. Dennis?
I want.
Well, you got the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life, right?
Selfishness and person could be in poverty, and it's something that he's wanted all his life, and he's going to get it if he has a lie, cheat.
Mm-hmm. Paul talked about the deceitfulness of or pride of worldly wisdom in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18. So it may seem reasonable, may sound good from the standpoint of human logic or human wisdom. Al?
Also, you have to look at compromise.
The spirit of compromise?
Mm-hmm.
Another place that we see this terminology used as far as deceit is in Matthew 13:22. We read about the riches, the deceitfulness of riches that would snatch the word from the heart of the individual. Kind of goes along with what Dennis said a moment ago about wanting. In Colossians 2, verse 8, he mentions human traditions. And in 1 John 1, verse 8, self-righteousness. And Ephesians 4:14, crafty men, sneaky. So, Satan has a whole arsenal that he can use to deceive people. Thomasina?
I was just reading your article from Sunday, and that casual Christianity is a perfect example. So many things there, they just, oh, well, this is okay, we're all right. And it's mm-hmm. very deceiving. That multiplies itself. So
yeah.
It's going
well
downhill.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, there's just a whole array of things that we could talk about And it all comes down to the point that he's making there in verse 13, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So whatever device that Satan decides to use in our particular case, he's going to, we've likened it to fishing lures. He's just going to keep plugging away and changing lures until he finds one that works, or eventually he might move on to somebody else if we keep saying no. But that's the way he operates, is he just plugs away with every lure in his tackle box. So, I kind of got some of these questions out of sequence. It really, the 10th question should go with verse 12, really. Let's skip on down there and let's talk about that, and then we'll come back to the others. And talk about what responsibilities we have toward each other in this matter of trying to keep one of our brethren from falling into this trap, into the sinful. Cheryl?
We encourage
each other in the faith. It's what he said. Yes. We need to, verse 13 is really the verse, but exhort one another day by day. Encourage. Make sure that we have, we have opportunities, and make sure we take advantage of those opportunities to help each other. Dennis? Of course, in verse 13 here, he's addressed, verses 12 and 13, he's addressed it to brethren. And then he says, exhort one another day by day. In other words, this is something that is an ongoing process. It's not just, in case we see somebody at the church building, and they show up once a month, and we say, oh, we sure missed you, guys, or whatever. No, this is if it gets to that point where, they come about once every two or three months or once a month or whatever, they're probably well along the road to apostasy. We need to try to nip it before it gets to that point. In that, just staying on top of it, because it's not a matter of sticking our nose in somebody else's business or trying to tread on somebody else's territory, but it's a responsibility that we have to help each other and to be on the lookout. If you were on a patrol in enemy territory and you saw a potential threat to one of your buddies, you wouldn't say, well, now, we're just going to see if this passes for the moment. A month from now we might give some attention to that. No, I mean, right then and there, you warn your buddy. Rick?
Well, we need to be observant and look for signs if somebody's having some problems.
Mm-hmm.
Offer help.
Yes.
Not wait for them to come crying with a plea. We should be up front.
Mm-hmm.
Be watching for things that are not going well.
Exactly. Dennis? Right, yeah. And I think that's one of the problems we have, is that we're hesitant. We're afraid we're going to, hurt somebody's feelings or whatever. Okay.
Could I bring up an example? I was
was over in one of the markets one day in Costa Mesa, and there was a lady that was around 50, 55, and she was having a little problem getting across the aisle because people were with their baskets were going out of the exit. And she was having trouble with her legs, I noticed. And so I was sitting there on a bench inside this place. It's like a Costco, you know, or something. And so I walked over to help her across the aisle. And when I said, could I help you across to the where you can sit down? She says, I'm an Islam. And I said, I'm a Christian. Can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
And I took her over and sat her down. And then there was a couple of men that were Persian. And they came in. They escorted her out to the door where they had a Mercedes sitting there to put her in. But, you know, I got to thinking, and it's funny that she, right away she said, well, nobody wants to help because I'm Israel.
Yeah. Well, of course, the text that we're studying is about responsibilities to our brethren. And that's, I think that's an area where we are deficient. We fall down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That we're to be exhorting each other going on. Hebrews 10:25, most people go there is when you aren't there, that this is a symbol. But it says to exhort one another.
Exactly.
And I believe one thing, this part of the deceitfulness of sin is thinking we can get by without exhorting one another.
Could be.
Like, well, I'm in service. What do I do?
Uh-huh.
But that's not our sole responsibility.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Karen?
One of the sermons you preached when we were here before was, it doesn't say you can't, but people don't care about the examples in the Bible. If the example of Christian living isn't in the Bible, we shouldn't be doing it. And just because it doesn't say we can't, you know, it gave us a lot of we can'ts with the Ten Commandments, but sin doesn't just knock on your door and say, here I am. It creeps in slowly, and it just escalates if we let it. But if we use the examples in the Bible, we should never get to that point.
Okay, let's move on. He cites again this passage from the Old Testament. If we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm to the end, while it is said today, if you hear his voice, harden not your hearts as the provocation. And we cross-referenced this last week when we were talking about verse 6. And then in verse 16, I need to move on down the... He said, for who, when they heard, did provoke? Did not all they that came out of Egypt by Moses? Well, that's a rhetorical question. Absolutely. For sure. And with whom was he displeased 40 years? Was it not with them that sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? Well, yeah, the answer to that. This is another affirmative. Of course it was. And to whom swear he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that were disobedient? Well, that's the problem. But then some people come back and say, well, you know what? We just didn't know that. You know, we were ignorant. Well, is ignorance an excuse for disobedience? No, no, absolutely not. Problem is, they rejected what they were told. They refused to accept the report. Well, the two spies, Joshua and Caleb, they refused their report. they decided that they'd already made up their mind what they wanted to believe. And so there was a willfulness on this their part, which goes back up to verse 10, where he said they do always err in their heart. They made that choice, and they turned their hearts back to Egypt, as he said in Acts 7:39. Thomas said,
in my experience, usually when people say, "I didn't know," what they didn't know was that they were going to get caught or held accountable, not that they didn't know they shouldn't have been doing it.
Right. So the consequence of that was that they fell in the wilderness, or they, verse 18, they did not enter into the rest. What rest was that?
The promised land.
Yeah. All right. And then he said in verse 19, and we see that they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. You notice, and this is a consistent pattern throughout the New Testament. Many times when you find disobedience mentioned, or obedience, depends on whether it's a negative or a positive, you'll also find belief in the same passage. I'm thinking John 3:36 is an example of that. Disobedience and unbelief go hand in hand. Whenever people choose not to believe, which is what these people did that he's talking about here, they disobeyed. And the side of that coin is, whenever you're disobedient, means you don't believe. Now, some people like to qualify unbelief. Well, you know, I still believe in Jesus, but... Well, no, if you really believe in him and believe in his word, you'll do what he says. Remember John 15:13? If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. So you can't say, I believe in him, and then disobey him. I mean, you could say it, but it's an erroneous statement. All right, what I asked you to do was to look at this last section of this chapter. And just using these verses and the points that are being made here, refute the doctrine of the impossibility of apostasy. You know, that, or better, well known as once saved, always saved. So, if you were talking to somebody that was leaning in that direction or believed that doctrine, how would you use what is said in these last few verses of, about last six verses here in chapter 3 to point them to the error of that doctrine? What compelling points does he make here to refute that? Scotty?
In verse 14, it says, if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance from the end.
So there is a need for continuing to hold on. That relationship is conditional. If we are partakers of Christ, if we hold fast. So it is conditional, partaking of Christ. All right? That's an excellent point. Carolyn? All right. Okay. These people were saved out of Egypt by God. On Jude 5. All the other examples we know. And then, so they were believers, but they became unbelievers. And we'll see in the next chapter the reason for that. But they were disobedient. Jim?
First you need to establish, like in the beginning of verse 12, we talked about their brethren.
Right.
So they're not, the people who believe that and say that, well, you weren't truly a believer in the first place. Well, here he's talking to believers saying, be careful, you could lose what you have.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in connection with that, you can't fall away from what you don't have. And he says in verse 12 also that the peril is falling away from the living God. Scott? Yeah, that is definitely a challenging text, and that would be a good study. But this is very obvious that if you don't, you fall away. If you don't remain faithful, you fall away. You're separated from God, and He cites the clearest example that these people would be familiar with, which is what happened to those in the wilderness. Yeah, that is the best example or explanation of how Satan operates, and that you're going to find in terms of the terminology of how Satan operates in James 1 there. Okay. Al?
You say, Lord, Lord, you're not going to get there unless you obey him.
That's right. Exactly. The thought doesn't change just because the chapter number changes. Let us fear, therefore. Therefore, let us fear. This goes right in the same subject that he's been dealing with. And the question is, what has he just said now that should cause these Hebrew Christians to fear or be fearful? Rick?
Strong in your faith, then you can be lured away by another doctrine. And that's what was kind of happening there, being pulled back into Judaism.
Exactly. And if there's no danger of falling, if once saved, always saved is true, why the warning? The warning would be meaningless if there's no danger of falling. No, there's nothing to fear. Wow! Once I start down the road to heaven, I've got it made. That's the doctrine of the impossibility of apostasy. So, it makes absolutely no sense to issue this forceful warning to people who are not in danger of falling away from God. It's ludicrous to say that. Mm-hmm.
Because we're so good at rationalizing and giving what we call reasons for not doing what's right. But the last thing that we'll do is call what we're doing sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be the first thing that we look at.
Right. Let's read, somebody read the first 9 verses here of this chapter. Just kind of get this thought in our mind. So go ahead, I'll take a volunteer. Carolyn, thank you.
Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest anyone seem to have come short of it. For indeed, the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest, as he has said. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time, as it has been said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterwards have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God.
So this is all about rest, and you can read as well as I can, so I'm not going to go through that that lesson that Brother Harkrider has on the Sabbath. It's an excellent little treatise on the Sabbath day. I would urge you to look at it and be familiar with it, and maybe mark that in your mind if you encounter a Sabbatarian argument sometime, and you want to look at a good outline of material to counter the Sabbatarian argument, that's a good chapter. That's really good. But I don't think we have any problem with that. And frankly, I haven't run on to many Sabbatarians around here. Maybe there's some around. I'm sure they are. There's some Seventh-day Adventist churches, but I just haven't had occasion to either bump into any of them or talk to anybody that's of that persuasion. So that, just keep that as a resource thought in mind, and we'll go ahead and look at the text here as it relates to the points that he's making and the issue at hand. He mentions here in verse 1 a promise being left of entering his rest. That is left open, I believe. The comparison that he makes here in these verses is that there was a rest that was a type, and remember we talked about types and shadows, I guess you would say the shadow. There was a rest that the people in Moses' day missed. But that really wasn't the ultimate rest that God has in mind for his children or his people. I know I'm getting ahead a little bit, but what is the ultimate rest?
Heaven.
Exactly. It's heaven. And so he's going to show here that what God has said and what he did in the past supports that proposition, that the rest that these people should be aspiring to, the rest that they should be striving to reach and need to be conscious of the danger of missing, is not something that was either in the past or something that was just, you know, some meaningful event along the way, but it's one that remains. A rest that remains based upon the promise that God had made and the provisions that he had made for that rest. Verse 1 again of chapter 4, talking about coming short of it. You know, there was this promise that was left open, but of entering the rest, but you know, the fear is that someone come short of it or miss it. And the reasons, of course, that they have not missed it is because they've got the good news. They know about it. But, you know, the people back in Moses' days heard about it too. They heard about that rest. But it was of no profit to them. They missed it. And why was that? Where was the disconnect? Because of their lack of faith. Or, verse 2, the word of hearing did not profit them because it was not united by faith with them that heard. That word united means to mix with, to temper together. I really did not enjoy my high school chemistry class. But there's one thing I remember from it. It's probably the only thing I can remember from it. And that was the difference between something being in suspension and something being in solution. What's the difference between being in suspension and being in solution in a chemistry class? If it's in solution, it's all dissolved and mixed together, isn't it? If it's just in suspension, and I remember, and some of the Southerners in here may remember, when I was growing up, and some of my grandparents especially, put some tea in their sugar water. You know, they'd put about 4 teaspoons of sugar in a glass of iced tea, then take a spoon and stir it about 3 times, and then, you know, it'd all fall to the bottom, and there'd be about that much sugar in the bottom of the glass. They didn't stir it long enough to dissolve the sugar. It was, you know, while they were, you know, really going around and around, it was in suspension. You could see all the little white things floating around in there, but then as soon as they stopped, it would settle to the bottom. That's the imagery here of this word. The problem is they had some faith, all right. It was stirring around a little bit, but they didn't let it become a part of them. It was not united. These good tidings, the word that was preached to them, the word that they heard about the rest that was promised, it didn't sink in. And consequently, they missed it. So he said, that's what we're trying to avoid. Because people can say they have faith, and it's what was mentioned a moment ago about the deceitfulness of sin, and one of them is that, you know, it's that momentary, emotional, superficial kind of faith as opposed to the kind that we really get our teeth into and sink in and let it, and it dissolves into our being. It's absorbed into our mind and our hearts. This is what he wants them to realize, that they could, if they don't unite this good news, and this in particular about the rest that God has in awaiting them, if it's not united by faith into their being, they're going to be just like the people back in Moses' day. They're going to miss it. They're going to miss the rest. And if they think that they're going to get it, they're sadly mistaken if they don't have the kind of faith that it takes to get there, because that's going to be tantamount to saying that God is not God, you know, because he tells them this is what's necessary But they are sorely deceived, and this goes back to the deceitfulness of sin. They're sorely deceived in thinking they can get there without the right kind of faith. Now he makes another point here. This sort of a time argument. Now Joshua talked about that day of rest, but then who else talked about it? Who else talked about a day of rest that he quotes? This is from the Psalm. David. This is from the Psalm. David. Now, let's get the sequence. And where does David fit into the timeline between Joshua and Jesus? Does he come after Joshua? Yeah. Round numbers, around 1000 B.C. Okay. So here's his point. If David is writing about a rest that is yet future, you know, 500 years after Joshua's time, round numbers, then obviously what David is writing about was not a reference to the rest that Joshua had promised the people. Because he said it's still yet to come, and he wrote that 500 years later. So if that's the case, then this has to do with something else than just a nice, comfortable camping spot across the river. And he goes back and says, this is parallel to what God did whenever he completed creation. From Genesis chapter 2, we learned that when God finished creation, what did he do? He rested. Or was he tired? No. The word rested in Genesis means to cease activity. He completed creation. The job was done. So therefore, it was stopped. He ceased that action, that creation action. So, the parallel is that until you get to the point where the job is completed, the mission is completed, you can't stop. So, just like when God completed his creation mission, you need to understand that there was yet a rest that is in the future, that it remains for those that would enter in, that hear the good tidings preached, and that if they fail to enter in, it's going to be because of disobedience. And so just like in Joshua's day, whenever they failed because they did not hear his voice and they hardened their hearts, then you need to learn from that, especially in view of the fact that there remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Verse 9. And we've already talked about what that is, and that's heaven. So, the Christian Sabbath is heaven. It's not Sunday. You'll hear denominational people talk about that and say, oh yeah, the Christian Sabbath, that's Sunday. The Jewish Sabbath, that's Saturday. The Christian Sabbath, the Sabbath rest, which is what Sabbath means, is heaven. Now, that's not to suggest that Sunday is an unimportant day. It's the Lord's Day. It's the first day of the week. It's the day that we assemble to commune together with each other and with the Lord, etc., etc. But it is never, ever referred to as the Christian Sabbath. So, So, how can one prevent his heart from being hardened? Obviously, this is the peril, the hardening of the heart. How can that be thwarted? How can they keep that from happening? All right, there's one, by encouraging each other, exhorting each other.
Being aware of the possibility of heart becoming hardened.
All right, being aware of the threat. Bob?
Reading the word, because it's sharper than a two-edged sword.
You're getting ahead of me, aren't you? Yeah, exactly. But it goes back to that uniting the word with faith, which comes from studying and reading, hearing it and giving heed to it. Okay. Did I see another hand or thought? And you know, he says again well, he said that, you know, we talked about that in verse 2. And it kind of goes with what Nancy said in verse 7, that he defineth a certain day today, saying in David, it's a long time afterward. That is, it's a long time after Joshua's day. If you shall hear his voice, harden not your heart. So it's a constant awareness. You know, remember Paul's statement, today is the day of salvation? The Hebrew writer talks about a today mindset. Yes, we need to think about this on a regular basis. Examine our own lives and measure ourselves by the Word, making sure that we're doing our best. Amy? Well, yes, Paul said in Romans 15:4, the things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that through patience and comfort of the Scriptures we might have hope. So the patience or steadfastness, which is what faithfulness and fidelity are all about, is hanging in there. And then the comfort, which you just alluded to, comes from knowing the Scriptures, and kind of goes back to the point that Bob made too about studying the Word and the power of the Word, which we'll get to next week. I see some of the classes are starting to come in, so we will move on next week in chapter 4.